My name's Janelle, as they said, Janelle Cornwell, and today I'm going to talk to you about space. I'm going to speak about workspaces, theoretical spaces, and subject spaces. Our concepts of space and time, as geographers will say, are socially produced, but they're not socially neutral. And looking at the way that things are on a global scale, many geographers are concerned with how capitalism is affecting places and producing space. Too many hands. Frequently cited examples of spatial production that entailed fundamental redefinitions of space include the enclosures of Tudor England, in which the commons were fenced off and privatized, and more recently, the USGS survey is often referred to, in which grid space was a process of privatization from which people could be excluded or included based on ownership. And we're all familiar with this kind of space if you've been in an airplane and you see over the Midwest and West what that looks like. That's the Iowa River. So these kinds of material and social productions of space are typically associated with the development and spread of capitalism, which is said to have an inherent logic that makes capitalist space grow. These kinds of material and, we all know the difference between real fences, the kind that you have to jump over, and imaginary fences, which only require an imaginary leap. But the distinction between those two is actually blurred by the fact that before these fences can be produced and in place, they have to be imagined. And so my research involves both imaginary and real space, real fences, excuse me. So the problem, however, when you're dealing with partitioned territory, both real fences and imaginary, is that something is always excluded. And except in the case of many theories of capitalist expansion, there's a girth of work from historical geographic materialist perspectives that offers compelling accounts of how the inherent logic of capitalist growth has enabled capitalism to take over the world. But this theoretical space is colonized, filled in, and completed by its object of inquiry, capitalism. And this amounts to a theoretical enclosure that excludes anything that is non-capitalist. J.K. Gibson Graham, one half of whom was supposed to be here tonight, but couldn't come because she was sick, called this theoretical colonization capitalocentrism. Excuse me. Inspired and bolstered by the work of feminist economists, Gibson Graham has shown how half of our economic processes worldwide are actually non-capitalist. And they've also shown how our imagination of the economy as capitalist has actually helped to reproduce those fences, both real and imaginary, on the ground. So most of what we recognize as the economy, or wage labor in capitalist firms, is actually the tip of the economic iceberg. Gibson Graham's language of the diverse economy opens up all of this space for researching, imagining, and producing knowledges of diverse economic processes and diverse non-capitalist processes. Among others, barter, gift, household labor, black market, and cooperative economic practices and enterprises are located in the bottom, formerly invisible, portion of the economic iceberg. And so tonight I'm going to talk about cooperative space. So one of the things that I wanted to know is that if we can understand capitalism, and I think most of us here probably do, as producing capitalist space, what I wanted to know is that how can we imagine and understand cooperatives and cooperative spaces as reproducing themselves? Collective Copies is a worker cooperative born out of a worker strike in Amherst, Massachusetts. 1983. They started with 4 members, and now they have 13 worker owners. In 3 locations, they operate, and they own 2 buildings collectively. The thing about worker cooperatives, though, is that there's no inherent logic for growth. Because they redistribute surplus to the workers themselves, they actually have a disincentive to grow. And indeed, at Collective Copies, there didn't seem to be any inherent logic to their growth. Yet, by all measures, this non-capitalist space is growing. In fact, they faced more work for equal pay, equal or less pay, more risk, and also a decrease in profit share when the startups for the first year or two were slow. So in the face of these disincentives, how were workers able to decide by consensus to grow this cooperative space? So these are the buildings they've purchased. The answer to this question for me can be found in subject space. The motivating factors for their growth came from their subjective experiences of the workers' lives. So rather than being owned or rented in the employment contract, they own their own time and workspace together. The workspace itself is cultivating an environment, is cultivating subjects who want to grow the business for personal and ethical reasons. So tonight I'm going to give a few examples of this. Collective ownership of the workspace has both material and subjective effects. One of my interviewees, without my asking, compared the floor layout at Collective Copies to one of a capitalist shop of similar size. The capitalist shop is hyper-stratified, while Collective Copies shop is flat. The layout of the floor is flat. And I knew what he was talking about because I'd interviewed the sole proprietor in her shop. Because she owns the space, she gets her way all the time. Moreover, thanks to the employment contract, not only the material space and the workers' movements in it are under her control, so too is their time. But not at Collective Copies. Nearly every worker owner that I talked to cited control over their time as one of the many benefits of working there. They can take little breaks to compose themselves in a moment of crisis. They can leave to get a check cashed or pick up the kids when necessary, and they can negotiate time off, and they have control of this together. And they don't think this is something that they can do at a regular capitalist copy shop. De Quiche, following Rancière and Massey, suggests that space becomes political by becoming the place where a wrong can be addressed and equality can be demonstrated. In this space, in this sense, the space of governance at Collective Copies is one of possibility in 2 ways. First, in the sense that it offers a place to make democratic pronouncements where a wrong can be addressed. And second, that it cultivates democratic subjects, those people that step into that space to make their democratic pronouncements. The political, says Jean-Luc Nancy, does not primarily consist in the composition and dynamics of power, but in the opening of a space, the place where community as such is brought into play. In the case of Collective Copies, governing the workplace together has produced material, not to mention subjective differences. They jointly own the space, the equipment, the products produced in the space, and the surplus that is realized when the products are sold. And that means that there's nobody outside the room telling you how much you're going to do, how much you're going to make, and how ridiculous the process is going to be. Through the process of consensus, they've decided to use recycled paper across the board, unlike most coffee shops. The pay is higher than industry average, and they have full health coverage for themselves and their family, and their families, And perhaps most importantly, the surplus, what is known as profit in a capitalist business, is collectively appropriated and distributed. So the moment of appropriation and distribution of surplus, what Harvey, following Marx, might call the nexus of alienation in a capitalist firm, is actually a moment of connection for worker-owned cooperatives. Surplus. This connection and having a say in what you do, I'll bless you, all day long, has been a transformative experience for the worker owners. Randy didn't know what a worker cooperative was before being hired at Collective Copies for 11 years ago. But now he's on what the workers jokingly call, the Rule the World Committee. Like other members on the Rule the World Committee, he's active in making proposals to expand the business. He's on the board of the United States Federation of Worker Co-ops, and he was one of the first worker owners to represent a co-op from the United States in SECOPA, the International Organization of Industrial, Artisanal, Service, and Producer Cooperatives, General Assembly in Oslo. He participates in these things because he, like the others of the World Committee, thinks that everybody deserves to have a dignified job like his. In the language of Gibson Graham, we could call his transformation resubjectivation. So that's where the movement begins. From their subjective experience, they're growing a good thing. They support each other inside their workplace, and they've expanded the business to invite more workers in and expand the circle. And they're expanding the circle of support by selling products made by other worker cooperatives. They started off with coffee and chocolate from Equal Exchange, a worker co-op in Boston, but it was so successful that they began to sell products from other worker co-ops, like Once Again Nut Butter, Green Mountain Spinnery, and even the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation. They're also reaching outside their workplaces to form alliances with other worker co-ops, participating in local, regional, and national networks. By growing the movement, they're not only growing more subject positions, they're reinforcing their own cooperative identity. Collective Copies is one of 11 worker co-ops in the Connecticut River Valley that have joined together to form the Valley Alliance of Worker Cooperatives, also known as VOC. This is a map that they produced. VOC provides a support network for cooperative culture, sharing information and marketing among worker co-ops to promote themselves. Beyond the Valley in Western Massachusetts, there are about 400 worker cooperatives nationwide. VOC is part of a regional alliance called the Eastern Conference for Workplace Democracy, and there are two other regional alliances in the nation, one in the Bay Area and one in the Midwest. And there's also a national alliance called the United States Federation of Worker Cooperatives that holds conferences for support, workshop, and culture sharing, not to mention inspiration and networking. So they're learning from examples like Mondragon and the cooperatives of Northern Italy. They're beginning to marshal surplus and envisioning things like worker co-op credit unions, cooperative-led development, pensions, and healthcare. Participating in the movement enables workers to see themselves as part of something bigger. And the thing, which again reinforces their cooperative subjectivity. And the thing about this space is that it is expansive. It may be slower in pace and smaller in scale, but unlike its capitalist counterpart, it integrates democratic subjects and ethical decision-making. This is a revolutionary vision from the inside out. So, I'm just going to leave it with a quote from one of the gentlemen that I interviewed, and I look forward to hearing your questions and your comments. Thanks. I hope I didn't take too long.